Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It's Chris S. from Bernardsville, New Jersey. Welcome. Welcome.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. I love this group. I've been here several times already, and there's an enthusiasm here that is very, very attractive. It's not all AA groups are like this. You know, I've been to many groups where it's almost like a castor oil remedy for alcoholism. You know, you go there to take your medicine, you know, and you go home. And Alcoholics Anonymous does not have to be like that. It can, you know, you can have a lot of fun at AA. You really can. You work this thing, your life starts to get better. And you can really begin to enjoy life. The promise that's up here behind me is one of my favorite. The most satisfactory years of your life are ahead of you. That's an awesome promise. Back when I was drinking, you know, in the 80s, I was always thinking back on the high school days, you know, how when alcohol was really working for me, you know, where the high school parties where, yeah, you got a little drunk and you crashed some cars and you got in fights, but you weren't really paying a really high price. You know, there was still some fun left in it. Well, that's not the way it was for the last 5 years of my drinking. There was no fun left in it at all. It was almost an effort to just survive being me, you know, is what I was drinking for, because life had become so untenable. You know, for the longest time, I didn't know what alcoholism was. I've heard people say that you catch alcoholism in AA, if you're lucky. And if you don't catch it, it'll kill you, which is kind of a strange thing. But I understand that today. After I was exposed to some recovery individuals who really had their wits about them as far as the recovery process is concerned, I started to understand what alcoholism was. For the longest time, I thought, okay, I'm an alcoholic because I drink a lot, you know. But if you drink a lot, that does not make you alcoholic. Okay, you know, I crashed a lot of cars. I had a lot of DUIs. I lost a lot of jobs. That's got to be another symptom of my alcoholism. That really isn't either. There's a lot of people who crash a lot of cars while they're drinking who are not alcoholic. I started to understand from these people, I started to understand what alcoholism was. And alcoholism is at the ground level basic. Alcoholism is a spiritual illness. It's a spiritual illness, and from that spiritual illness sprout the symptoms of alcoholism. And one of the symptoms of alcoholism is excessive drinking that is coupled with an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. And that's just one of the symptoms of alcoholism. But if you have that, that's one of the most deadly symptoms of alcoholism. That kills a lot of us. And it kills us before we even understand what's going on. I've worked with a lot of people over the years, and I've worked with people for years and sometimes even decades who still can't, for the life of them, they can't really believe that they're powerless. They can't really believe that there's an obsession in their mind that can activate and force them into drinking alcohol again. They continue to believe that every time they pick up a drink, they've changed their mind and decided to drink. And, you know, I say to them, okay, you decided you were having a pretty good week and you decided to go home from work and, you know, buy a 12-pack of beer and you know, get a DUI and end up in jail not knowing why you're there, you know, and losing your job. You decided all that. Well, that was a pretty smart decision, you know, and they're looking at me like I'm crazy. But that's an aspect of the illness, alcoholism, is to be subject to a thought in your mind that's going to override all other thoughts that we should put alcohol in our body now. And if you go untreated, if you are not offered a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, you're never going to be in charge of whether you drink again. And, you know, that is a really tough concept to grasp. And our big book spends 40-some pages covering that. And yet we'll read the big book 35 times and not believe that that's really true for us. You know, that's just typical of the alcoholic. Another aspect of alcoholism is the phenomenon of craving, which is basically one drink always asks for the second drink, and the second drink insists on the third, and the third demands the fourth. And the more alcohol you have in your body, the stronger the craving for alcohol is. And that used to happen to me, and I understood that a little. I understood that if I was going to start drinking, I was going to finish the deal. You know, I was going to get it done. And if you asked me to go out drinking or whatever, I had to really think ahead. Because I wasn't going to be worth a lot for the next 10 or 20 hours. So, you know, that's part of the aspect of the illness. But another aspect of other aspects of alcoholism that we don't necessarily fully realize are the spiritual aspects of alcoholism. In the book, it talks about being restless, irritable, and discontented, in the doctor's opinion. We alcoholics are restless, irritable, and discontented. And unless we can at once feel that sense of ease and comfort from drinking a half a gallon of whiskey, you know, whiskey we see other people drinking with impunity, damn it, you know, why am I different? You know, that restlessness, that irritability, that discontent, that's an aspect of alcoholism. It is not life on life's terms. It is not something that we necessarily need to treat with medication. It's untreated alcoholism in most cases. Other aspects of alcoholism, self-centered fear, anxiety, depression, guilt, shame, remorse, all of these emotional states are symptoms. They're one characteristics of the way alcoholism presents in our lives. If we leave our alcoholism untreated, if we don't participate in our own recovery program. Toward the end of my drinking, my life was an absolute living hell. I really look back on it and I see how could I have possibly survived feeling that bad. Yes, I was physically sick all the time. I was drinking so much my eyes would be yellow on certain mornings. They'd look at me like, well, you know, are you going into liver failure on us? I mean, it was that bad. And I, you know, the type of hangovers that are beyond hangover, they're it's like you're completely shattered. That was bad enough, but the worst part was the loneliness, the anxiety. The sense that the world had done me wrong, you know, all these horrible emotional feelings and resentment. I would have these burning resentments from some injustice or other that somebody perpetrated on me, or, you know, it could be a political party, it could be a boss, it could be a family member, it could be an ex-friend. I mean, I would not let go of this anger that I had toward these individuals. And this is really the way it was. And a typical day would be like this. I would come to in the clothes I was in the night before, because usually I just passed out and hit the floor and somewhere in the middle of the night crawled into bed. The alarm would be going off. It was like 7:30 and I had to be at work at 8. So I'd struggle up, you know, I'd stagger into the bathroom. I'd do my vomiting calisthenics. I'd brush my teeth a little bit, you know, look in the mirror, you know, and stagger out to the car. Now, I hadn't had a drink since about 8 o'clock the night before, but I would have blown the breathalyzer. I would have gotten a DUI going to work the next day. I had so much alcohol coming out of my pores, still in my system. My liver couldn't process the amount of alcohol I drank in an 8-hour period of time. It just, it backed up. So I'd drive to work, and I'd have one of those hangovers where my head is ringing. Your head is just like ringing. Just crazy. It's just horrible feeling. And I would be swearing to God I am never going to drink again. Today is going to be the day that I am not going to stop at the liquor store and buy alcohol. I have to give this up. I don't want to feel like this anymore. I've got to give it up. And I really meant it. If you would have given me a lie detector test at that point in time, it would have shown that I was absolutely telling the truth. I am going to give up alcohol today. I'd get maybe half a sandwich down. Most of my calories were alcohol calories at this period of time. I'd get half a sandwich down maybe. It'd be like 1 or 2 o'clock, and I would start to revisit that decision I made earlier in the day. Yeah, I know. I promised myself I wouldn't drink today, you know. And
excuse me, one second.
Yes.
Did somebody here call AAA? They are here to unlock your car. Sorry about that.
That's right. So I would be, I'd be swearing to God I'm never, ever going to drink again. And I would be revisiting this decision that I made. And what would happen would be, I would consider the decision that I made earlier to be an overreaction to a problem I really could take care of myself, you know? So I think I'm going to have to alter that decision a little bit. As a matter of fact, on the way home today, I'm going to have to stop. I think I'll stop at the liquor store and I'll buy maybe just a pint, well, maybe a quart. And I would. I'd buy a quart of vodka or a quart of bourbon or something, and I would go home and I would start drinking. And this cycle was a never-ending cycle. And on the weekends, I would get drunk and pass out and come to and get drunk 4, 5, or 6 times on a weekend. You know. And if you do this, the quality of your life is absolutely in the toilet, no matter what you think. You can't enjoy anything when you're so chained to a poison that you have to put into your system. You have no freedom. And that's really the way my life was. And I didn't understand alcoholism. I didn't understand what was going on with me. I thought that I needed this alcohol to be able to cope because the world was a harsh place and a lot of problems are coming at me. And I need a little bit of relief. You know, I'm different than most people. You know, I feel the pains of injustice at a deeper level or something. You know, I need a little bit of anesthesia, you know, to take care of this for me. I don't know what I thought, but it was all wrapped up in the alcoholic insanity that was going through my life. Now, the unfortunate thing about alcoholism and about recovery is you're not going to understand what recovery is going to offer you until you experience it. Recovery is experiential. It's not a theory. We have to live the program of recovery, and we have to experience the spiritual exercises of the steps before we will even have a clue what they're going to offer to us. I thought that by going to Alcoholics Anonymous and not drinking anymore, my life would get a little bit better because I wouldn't be so violently ill all the time. But that's really all I gave Alcoholics Anonymous credit for at that period of time. Now, if you're new or just coming back, or if you have not gone through the 12 steps with a sponsor or an experienced spiritual advisor, there's going to be two things that are absolutely true in your life that you are not going to comprehend. One of them is you're in way more trouble than you think you are. If you're an alcoholic and you have not gone through the steps, you are in way more trouble than you think you are. Inherent in alcoholism is an utter inability to accurately assess just how much trouble you're in. You are not going to get it. You are not going to get it. Conversely, on the good side of that, if you've not been through the steps and you're newer, just coming back, you're not going to be giving Alcoholics Anonymous enough credit for what it can do in your life. Because again, how can we understand an experience we haven't had yet? It's impossible. So you get to hear people up at the podium who have had a spiritual awakening as a result of the 12 steps, and you can see a little bit about what happens with people and how they recover. But it's very, very difficult to see how it's going to apply to you. You have to take it on faith that this program will work for you and actually work it. And that's hard for some of us to do. There are those who cannot or will not give themselves to this simple program. And that's really a shame. Because not only could you survive alcoholism, but your quality of life can just go out the roof. Now, I'm one of these guys that just wanted to know everything. I'm like a bizarrely untrained intellectual. And, I need to know, And, somebody said to me one time, Chris, know and why is like the booby prize in AA. You know what I mean? And I just couldn't understand what they were saying to me. But, I needed to know. And when it came time, I understood my alcoholism, but when it came time to come to believe that there was a power greater than myself, I had issues there, all right? Now, during my heyday of drinking, I would watch some TV, and there would be the televangelists on, okay? And I got sober during the heyday of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and Jimmy Swaggart and all those horses' asses who were out there robbing, the elderly of their pension money. And I just, an alcoholic can see hypocrisy 100 miles away unless they're looking in a mirror. And I just thought, if these are God's like front three, I'm going to give this a pass. I completely misunderstood the spirituality. I completely understood the God of your understanding when I first got in here. And I really thought I was going to have to join the televangelist type of bandwagon. I had no real clue about what this was about, Okay, God of your own understanding, but I know what you mean. Is really what I was worried about. So for months in AA, I was dodging that question. Okay, I didn't want to look squarely at that. But if you jump ahead to the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. A spiritual awakening is awakening to the consciousness of the presence of God in your life. God will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. So obviously this God thing is very important for us, especially if we happen to be the type of people who are in real trouble from alcoholism. Now, again, I was looking at God. I was looking at my bizarre conception of God that basically came from my childhood and maybe a little bit of my early adolescence. My picture of God was this deity away from and apart from this plane of existence up in the heavens, with the white robes and the beard and, St. Peter and the harp players, sitting there with a ledger, keeping track of every single thing I did wrong. Now, this was basically my behind-the-scenes concept of God. Now, where that came from, I haven't a clue. But I had to get a God-ectomy pretty damn fast, having that kind of a conception, like the judgmental ruler is going to burn me in hell. For thinking bad thoughts about Emily McGillicuddy. That type of higher power had to be cast out pretty quick, or I wasn't going to be buying into it. So I started on a quest, a spiritual quest, reading a lot of the books. I read a lot of the books that we all get handed, The Road Less Traveled, and Mere Christianity, and My Utmost for His Highest, and Emmett Fox, and people were passing these things around, like drug dealers in the early meetings that I was going to, and I was reading them all, and I was not really able to buy into any specific formula, But what I did was I started to develop a little bit of my my spiritual consciousness. And somewhere along the way, I took Ebby's advice, which is basically, he said to Bill, if you don't like, if you don't like your current, my conception of God, if you don't like Christianity as it is right here and right now, why don't you form your own conception of God? And I took that literally, and I started to do that. I probably for the last 15 years or so, I've studied comparative religions pretty heavily and gotten into a lot of Buddhism and first century Christianity, a whole lot of really good things. And I came to a conclusion that a lot of the mystics and a lot of the spiritual geniuses and religious geniuses of the past had a lot of things in common. And one of the things they had in common was they didn't look at God as a verb, as a noun. They looked at God as a verb, more of a power and less of a thing. Because you get to a point in spiritual development where if you try to box a concept of God in, then you've limited that particular God to the inside of that box. And I also had to look on my experience. Had I recovered from alcoholism after going through the steps? Absolutely. Was there a power working in me and through me that brought me back from the gates of death and insanity? Absolutely. So this was a working part, an experienced part of my understanding, and I started to see a little bit about what this step process really was. In step three, we make a deal. We make a deal that we are going to live a spiritual life. We're going to seek, probably never find, to an intellectual degree, we're probably never going to find intellectually God, but we'll be able to experience God. And in the third step, we make a decision to do so. Why do we need this? Because we need power. Power is the thing that we lack, and we don't understand that we lack it. We lack the power to stay away from a drink. We lack the power to recover. We lack the power to be able to recreate our lives. We lack the power to heal personal relationships around us. We lack the power to control our own emotional natures. These are things that we lack the power to do on our own. So in step three, it's basically telling us that there's a path, there's a process. We have to buy into it. Are you in or are you out? And the path is steps 4 through 12. Now, a lot of times people would ask me, and they were very serious about this, that, you know, it would be at a party or it would be the day after some debacle, and they would come up to me and they'd say, Chris, what is wrong with you? What is wrong? Do you know what you did last night? You drove around Mr. Shaw's front lawn driving all of his bushes over. You know what? What made you think to do something like that? And I mean, I was always doing crazy stuff, like you know, removing neighbors' shrubberies with my car or something, you know. And that question always caught me off guard. What's wrong with you? And you're like, what's wrong with you? You know, I was having a good time. But it always worried me because I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know why I did that. I knew I drank a lot and I did crazy things when I drank, but I didn't know what was wrong. Now, if you've not done a four-step, if you've not done the four-column inventory on resentment, the inventory on fear, the inventory on your harms to others with an emphasis on sex and relationships, if you've not done that, you don't know what's wrong with you. You think you know what's wrong with you, but you don't have a clue. Once I got through this four-step, it promises that I will know the causes and conditions of my failure at life. I will know the root cause of what is wrong, the underlying conditions of what is wrong. I will be able to get down to the absolute facts about my defects of character, my shortcomings, the roadblocks that are in the way of me and a successful life. And I started to see that it was this whole perception that I had of the world. Its foundation was a foundation of selfishness and self-centeredness. I truly believed that I was an island, that I was put here on earth and I had to interact with all these crazy people and, you know, I had to protect myself. I had this sense of self-centeredness. I was self-absorbed. I saw everything from this very, very unhealthy sense of self. And it informed all of my decisions in my life, and all of my decisions were based in selfishness, how I can better position myself. And studying some of the spiritual masters, some of the wonderful mystics and people out there who've paved such a great path for us to learn, you know, how to do this life thing. All of them say that the more that you grow spiritually, the more that sense of isolation leaves you. You get more of a sense of compassion and a sense of understanding that you are not the only person on this planet. You know, that we are all one, you know, which is a really tough concept for an alcoholic to believe. You know, we are one? I don't think so. You are you and I am me. But you know, Buddhism, Christianity, all of these disciplines teach compassion. And the further you get down the spiritual road, the more compassionate you become for your fellow man. That's just given in the disciplines. That's why you see so many saints giving so much of themselves. There's no other thing to do. So anyway, in step four, I've identified some of my character defects. In step five, I need to share them. I need to start to become honest with these. If I hold on to this information, it will change. If I just do a four-step and don't discuss it with anybody or whatever, the power is going to disappear from it. The understanding of my problems are not coming at me. They're coming from me that I get from the four-step. That'll slowly disappear, and the world will start to come in on me again, and all of a sudden I'll be on my own, and it'll be them against me again. So I need to share this with a sponsor, someone experienced, and a spiritual advisor, and I need to become honest with them because I need to say this. I need to say that this is what's wrong with me. And after doing that, I need to start to become willing to have the character defects that are blocking me off from a quality of life removed. And I need to humbly ask God to remove these character defects. Now, you know, a great position of humility is to be defeated. And when I got through this fourth and this fifth step, I really understood that I had been defeated by these character defects. I'm a fairly smart guy. I'm fairly competent. You know, you put me in certain situations and I can do really well. At 33 years old, I was living in a room at my mother's. I had a $100 car, a terrible job, a family that had left, three DUIs, and all I had left was me in the bottle. Now, you can't be too awful talented and allow that to happen. So I had to understand that this was not because I was stupid. This was not because I was unlucky. This was because I was alcoholic and I lacked power. I lacked the power to be able to create a good life. Alcoholism gets in your way. So from an attitude of humility, from an attitude of defeat, I need to ask God to remove these defects of character and start to develop an attitude whereby I am actively inviting God into my life as much as I can possibly be conscious of it, to give me that power, to allow that power to operate in and through me so that I can do a better job on this planet. Not just so I can get the Ferraris, you know, and the big house, but so that I can be of real use to God and my fellow man. That's really the most important thing. Because if I built my whole life on a foundation of selfishness and self-centeredness, the only antidote to that is to try to work toward being as selfless as possible, as generous and as compassionate as possible. And that's inherent in the step process. If you've missed that, you've missed the whole thing. So there's a great line in the 12 and 12. It says, God will not render us white as snow without our cooperation. So the question then must be, how then shall I cooperate? I want to cooperate. Listen, every day my life is getting better in this Alcoholics Anonymous thing, and I want it to continue to do so. How do I participate? And it really is the step process. Now, if my defects of character are going to be removed, I need to participate in that removal. How do I do that? It's really simple. The next two steps are how you participate in the removal of your character defects. You become willing to make direct amends to the people and institutions whom those character defects have harmed. And then you actually go out and make direct amends to those people and those institutions. And I put actually in front of it because I know so many people that I've worked with in the past think that if they agree with these steps in theory, they're working a program. But it's an action program. It's not an intellectual program. You can't go to 12-step meetings a week and share about step 9 and not do it. It's not going to do you any good. You actually have to go knock on the doors. You got to pay the money back. You got to do some traveling, you know. So anyway, I became willing to have these defects of character removed. I did some traveling. I did some paying the money back. I think the toughest amends were really, you know, admitting to somebody that I had harmed them and that I was acting as a very selfish, self-centered horse's ass. You know, those were probably my hardest because I was always attached to what other people were thinking of me. And I always thought that I would be made to feel really small doing those kinds of amends. And really, in actual fact, it was exactly the opposite. People were quite impressed that there had been enough of a change in me and enough of an awareness in me to realize I had caused these harms and want to actually do something about setting them right. So I'd say out of 100 amends, you know, 99 of them went well. And then there was one boss who kept throwing me out of his office. But that worked out in the end anyway. It really did. We ended up getting very, very close on my like third attempt. He actually listened to me. So anyway, and I was able to make that right. The amends put muscle in your recovery. They really do. To the extent that you do them is the extent of the power that you have in your program. And power is everything for us. Here's what happens in AA. I've been in AA. Next month I'll have 22 years. God willing. What I've seen, there's no one left from like the first meeting I went to. There is such a turnover in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've got my own specific theory about that. Where do people go? Picture this meeting. Let's just say I'm not really sure that you did. I don't think you did. But let's say that every single meeting every week, you make the announcements. Anybody new or just coming back, and you'll get two or three hands every single week. Now, if everybody stayed, there'd be another 150 people in this meeting by this time next year, and then another 150 by the end of the second year. You wouldn't be able to hold the meeting in this town after 10 years. But we know that doesn't happen. We know as many people that come, That's how many people leave. Now, where do they go? My personal theory is that if you don't put enough into this deal, you won't get enough power back from it to be able to stay. And you will delude yourself and you will tell yourself that I'm leaving because I don't like those meetings anymore, or I've outgrown AA, or whatever lie you'll tell yourself. But if you're really alcoholic, leaving AA is insane. So whatever lie you tell yourself, you know, I don't need it anymore or whatever, I believe that you didn't put enough into it to get enough power back to be able to stay. And it's all about power. It's power to resist the first drink. It's power to be able to stay here. Now, the people that I've seen who've done a really, really good job with amends, almost all of them are still around. Almost all of them are card-carrying AA members in good standing. That's not the case for people who had a million service commitments. I've seen people do 5 service commitments a week for 10 years, and all of a sudden they're gone. But you won't see the same thing with somebody that's worked a program, that's done really strong amends, that continues to carry the message to other alcoholics and works with sponsees. All right, step 10. I'm trying to develop a spirituality. I'm bumping my way along this spiritual way of living, and I'm trying the best I can, but I've got so much to learn. And it's a good thing that it's a journey and it's not a destination where you get to and can stop. Growing spiritually happens right up until they throw dirt on you. I need to start applying the lessons that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous in a day-to-day basis. Now, I've learned how to clean up the wreckage of my past. That's really what I've learned until I get up to step 10. But I need to stay current. I need to not continue to cause harm. I need to continue to keep my life as clean as I can keep it. And step 10 really is my walking around step, my reactive step as far as spiritual growth is concerned. If you read step 10 in the big book, it covers every single step. 1 through 9 and 11 and 12 are all encompassed in step 10 in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So I need to learn where to apply those spiritual principles and spiritual exercises on a day-to-day basis to keep me from shooting myself in the foot all the time. And I started to practice that a number of years ago, and I started to be conscious of it, be present to the fact that I need to be applying step 10 as I move through the day. And there's been examples that I could share where, you know, I did something stupid at work, and normally I try to ignore and you know, go around and disappear and hope the problem will go away. When I was learning to apply step 10, I got right in it, and I directly made amends and I admitted my wrong, and I did that whole deal feeling a little bit stupid, but learning that is in my best interest, because an unpracticed step is corrosive to your spiritual condition. If you know that there's some step work you need to do and you don't do it, that's corrosive to your spiritual condition. That blocks you off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and that can kill you as dead as a doornail. So step 10 is something that I know I need to take seriously and try to learn to just be as honest and as forthright as I can be. You know, try to tell you, you know, what I'm going to do, and then do what I tell you what I'm going to do. You know, I come from the construction trade. That's alien. You know, think of somebody in the construction trade who will actually tell you what they're going to do and then actually do what they're going to tell you what you're going to do. I mean, I was this bizarre, individual. Actually practicing that, you know, it made me look a little bit weird. Anyway, step 11, seek through prayer and meditation. Now, prayer and meditation was something I knew a little bit about prayer from going to church when I was younger. I knew a little bit about meditation from studying the Beatles, you know, and the Maharishi. You know, so I knew just about enough to get myself into trouble, really, with prayer and meditation. So went back to the book and started just following directions. And there was a period of time where I just did what it said. Upon awakening, we look at the day ahead. You know, an interesting thing, a lot of us have perceptions of meditation that really have been tainted by the Beatles and some of the other people who have brought Eastern meditation into our consciousness. But the fact of the matter is Western meditation wasn't about sitting in a lotus position and emptying our minds. What Western meditation was about deep thought about a specific subject. I'll give you, for instance, one example is a general will meditate the battle the day before. You know, some of the examples in the step book and the big book talk about meditation. And it says, take a prayer. Think really deeply about that prayer. See how it applies to you. So meditation really is, it's more about directed thought than it is about mind emptying. You know, that came from the Eastern traditions. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I do that too. But I think what they're talking about in the recovery program is consider your plans for the day. I think we need to do that every morning. And that's a type of meditation. And prayer is something that I don't necessarily think God needs me to do. I think prayer helps me to focus on the divine. And the more I focus on the divine, the closer I'll stay to practicing spiritual principles. Step 12, I highly recommend for anybody, if you have questions about sponsorship or how you should be handling the people who are your charges, there is an absolutely wonderful chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's called Working with Others. And when I first read that chapter, I thought it was some archaic, bizarre. Why didn't they take this out? This is not how we do it in New Jersey. This is some harsh stuff. You know, if the person won't do the steps with you, you'll need to drop them. That's not what we do in New Jersey. We give them our phone numbers and tell them to call us when they have a problem. And I have been two types of sponsors in my life. For the longest time, I was the drama coach type of sponsor. I expected daily or at least weekly updates from you about what's going on in your life, and I expected to see you at meetings, and I expected to be the guy to give you your chip. Okay, that's was first couple of years. That's what type of sponsor I was. Now, if lack of power is an individual's dilemma, if a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps is really the treatment for the condition alcoholism, why would I be telling somebody to go to meetings and give me a call? What good would that possibly do, getting updated on a daily basis on the new drama du jour? What I'm actually doing is I'm actually being dishonest. I'm saying, listen, I'm your higher power. Call me and I'll give you some advice. Why would I do that? You look in the chapter Working with Others, and it's basically on, it's very cut and dried on the first visit. You know, we tell him about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We tell him about the first two steps. If he's willing, we take him through the first two steps. Then we leave the book. Read the book. On our second visit, they've read the book. We can now do a third step with him because we can ask him, are you willing to go to any lengths? And they'll understand what any lengths looks like because we've let them read the book. That's what any lengths is. And then we start taking them through the steps. I saw that as a very harsh, very impersonal type of a way of working with someone when I first read it. Because I thought we were supposed to be their friends. Now, would you like a doctor that just wants to hang out in the waiting room and talk with you all the time? Or would you like a doctor who's going to do the deal and heal you? You know, going to do the operation. I don't want a waiting room sponsor either, you know. I want somebody that's going to get in there and that's going to do the deal with me. I want to survive this thing called alcoholism. You know what our survivability rates are, for God's sake? There's all kinds of different statistics, and most of them are skewed because the people taking the statistics don't understand the difference between an alcoholic and a heavy drinker. But even if they're really wrong, you have got to say that if only about 10% or less of us survive alcoholism, if we're alcoholic, we're going to die from it or we're going to die with it. 90% of the people die from it, and the lucky 10% die with it. And I want to be one of those lucky 10%. So I want to take this stuff seriously. Now, in this chapter, it basically talks not necessarily about being a sponsor, but about being a guide, a spiritual guide through the steps. And then it talks a lot about freedom. You know, there are a lot of groups out there today who really want you to be attached to them and attached to their sponsorship lineage or whatever until kingdom come. I mean, you can be 40 years sober and you got to call your sponsor to ask them if you can buy a car or something. I mean, there really are. The book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about freedom. Get through the steps and now you are free. You need to follow certain spiritual principles and live a spiritual life and work with other alcoholics, but you're not beholden. You're not supposed to be beholden to anybody but God. God is going to direct your thoughts. God is going to be your advisor. And I see that as a wonderful, wonderful promise. All of these promises that are in the book Alcoholics Anonymous are about freedom. I didn't know I was going to get freedom. I thought that I was going to get relief. I thought that I would be able to not drink one day at a time, even if my ass was going to fall off. I was just going to hang on and not take that first drink. And what happened to me was the problem's been removed. The alcohol problem's been removed. My self problem is still here. I need to work on that on a daily basis, because if I drop my guard and rest on my laurels, on yesterday's accomplishments, my attitude will change slowly and imperceptibly. I will go backwards. I will go backwards into self. And if I go backwards far enough, I'll be back in the bondage of self. And once you're in the bondage of self, it's a slow decline right back to the drink. You know, you've already lost a long time usually before the drink happens. You've fallen short on your spiritual program of action. My life today is extraordinary. When I first got sober, I was a bad electrician, just burning stuff up and getting electrocuted. And, you know, if somebody said, hey, you know, said to you, oh, yeah, Chris wired your house, you know, okay, I'll sleep by the door. I mean, you know, it was really a bad deal. I could tell you stories that are just horrific. Once I got sober, I really did, for one reason or another, I really did focus in on this Alcoholics Anonymous thing. In the beginning, I was focusing in on the fellowship because it was the first place I'd really felt at home. It was the first place I really started to get friends that I didn't think, you know, just wanted me for my money or drugs, you know. And I embraced the fellowship. I'm so glad that I did that. But then I found recovery in the fellowship. And I learned that the fellowship doesn't treat alcoholism. The steps treat alcoholism. And I was able to integrate the step process now within the fellowship, and it just was an awesome experience, and I concentrated on that with all of my my mind and all my heart. But I did have to work, too. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. That's a spiritual principle also. So I had jobs. And slowly, as I began to recover from alcoholism, I just became more employable. I just became more ethical and more honest and less you know, less likely to concoct, you know, crazy stories to explain bizarre behavior. And that went a long way to trust. I slowly started getting promotions. And with the, it says also, one of the promises is we will outgrow fear. Fear is never going to leave us, but we will grow larger than the fear. Now, I always had a fear of people, fear of how they were going to look at me, fear of rejection. So it was hard for me to go after good jobs or ask for promotions. I was always just, you know, settling. And with the removal of that type of fear, with not the removal, but me growing larger than that fear, I started to go after better jobs. I started to look at promotional opportunities. I started to take chances and place my hand in God's. Look, I'll fill out the resume. You're in charge of everything else. And I started to get better and better jobs. And, you know, today, I've considering where I've come from in my past, I've got a pretty extraordinary job. Relationships, friendships. I blew every friendship up I had. I mean, you know, it would be me or it would be them. A lot of times it would be me saying, you know, they said something the other, I don't want to be in their presence anymore. You know, they talked about my drinking or something. Whatever. I'm out of here. You know, and what I would do is I would chop away one more friend, chop away one more relationship. And it got to the point at the end of my drinking where there was a few guys that would hang out with me, you know, and like do massive amounts of cocaine or something. And, you know, they didn't even have names at the end. They were like Weezer and Green Man, you know. And I really, to this day, I don't know who these people were. And, you know, that was the extent. You know, they really looked like actual characters from Dr. Seuss, too, you know. And to this day, I don't remember who they were. But today, by just becoming less selfish and more ethical and, you know, some of the good parts of my personality have stayed and some of the bad has gone, I've got an extraordinary array of friends, just an amazing amount of friends. I don't have enough time in the day. The thing I feel bad about is not being able to connect with all of these people to the extent that I would like to spend the time I would like to with them or you know, call them on the phone or whatever. I don't have enough time in the day. Romantic relationships. Now, I had just one bizarrely bad relationship, especially in the last 10 years of my drinking. I cannot even tell you. The last girlfriend I had while I was drinking, I got through a prison pen pal program, okay, which I wanted, you know, if you're new or coming back, this is not recommended, okay? We know you're lonely, you know, but don't do that. It was just a debacle of magnificent proportions. And so, you know, I came into AA and, you know, I did my year because they used to say, don't get in a relationship till you have a year. Well, nobody would have touched me in my first year anyway, but, you know, I like to think that I waited a year and then I started dabbling and it's very, very stupid to break up two newcomers, you know, two ding-a-lings that think they're going to make a bell. The stupidest thing you can do is break them apart because they'll just go mess up two other people, okay? So you should just leave them alone and let them, you know, if they survive, you know, they'll be rocketed into the steps from the emotional pain of this whole travesty. So that's really what happened to me. I was rocketed into doing step work to try to survive the pain and the alcoholism that was running right after me. So it got to the point where I was a better person, so I was attracting better people, and things got quite good. I got married about a year and a half ago to the one of the most wonderful women I've ever known in my life. I've known this woman since I was 19. And we reconnected on Facebook, and she was a very, very close friend of mine back in the day. And it felt like going home. And, you know, I got to tell you, I didn't think this type of a relationship was possible. I always thought there was going to be negotiation and maneuvering. There's always going to be that. And that's not what I'm experiencing today. So, like, every single aspect of my life, my family life, my work life, my social life, my AA life, it's all on an extraordinary footing today. And it's not because I'm smart or lucky or whatever. It's because I've just somehow been able to be consistent with the recovery process. And I just kept at it. I didn't have any better plans. And each year my life gets better. Hence the most satisfactory years of my life are ahead of me. Great being at this group. Thanks for letting me come.